Greetings and welcome to Flanagan's Ecologic. I am your host, Ted Flanagan, and today it's Jack Grow. He is the Director of Environmental Programs for the National Football League, and we're going to be talking about all the ways that the NFL has made a positive impact in the communities where it plays. Happy to have Jack on the podcast today. Hey, Jack, welcome to the podcast. It's very good to meet you.
Hey, Ted, same here. Nice to see you.
And where are you sitting? Are you in Rhode Island? Am I getting your geography correct?
I am sitting in Rhode Island, not too far from the beach, as a matter of fact.
Oh, that's a good thing. All right. So, and I always like to ask, I used to ask people all about their backgrounds and everything, but what are you up to today? I know you've got a really busy schedule. I know you're off to Europe. You've been in Detroit. I mean, what's hot on the plate today and this week?
Well, right now we're doing the finish up work for the NFL draft. So it's, this is the least exciting part of the job, probably, looking at all the metrics, collecting data, putting together a report and finishing up. So it's not the most exciting part of the job, but it's necessary so that we can document what we've done.
And then what would you say is the most exciting part of the job? Is it?
Definitely being on site and being at the events. Not necessarily the like the draft or Super Bowl itself, but the other events that we do in the community, community greening events, building community gardens, doing all these kinds of projects. That's the most exciting and fun part of it. And to see how local communities interact with us around the events. The NFL events get everybody excited. They get them enthusiastic, get them energized. But what we try and do is channel that enthusiasm and energy into projects that the community really needs and really wants. So that to me is the fun, exciting part of the job.
You've been there. I've already teed this up in the intro that you've been there over 30 years working for the NFL. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. We started in the 1993-94 season.
And were you the first, you and your wife, I guess, she's been involved with us all along. And were you the first environmental program directors there?
We were the first environmental program folks in professional sports, as far as we know. We went to the league. The league was getting ready for Super Bowl 28 in Atlanta. This would have been the 93-94 season. And myself and a partner from Atlanta went to the league and just simply asked them what they were doing about the environmental impact of Super Bowl. That was the question that we asked. Nobody had ever asked that question to our knowledge at any sports event, conference center, convention center in the United States. And the senior vice president at that time, a guy named Jim Steak, who really created Super Bowl. He's the guy that put the super in Super Bowl. And his response was, what do you think I should do? And that was, you couldn't have asked for a better, more open door.
Receptive, right.
Yeah,
and then I think about a huge sporting event. You've got all these people that are driving to an event. You've got all these people consuming food, and you've got the stadium using tons of energy and water and everything else. You got carbon emissions. How do you get your arms around that?
Well, we started small, since it was the very beginning and nobody had ever looked at impact before. We started with the most obvious issue, which was solid waste, which you just talked about. When you talk about food and you talk about the materials and you talk about all the stuff, generate a lot of potentially a lot of solid waste. And again, no one had ever set up a recycling project in any sports facility or public space that we were aware of. There was some municipal recycling already going on, programs that my wife and I had actually worked on, some municipal recycling programs. But that was our first foray into trying to address the environmental impact. And then as the years go by, we look at, you go out and you look at the dumpsters and you say, well, gee, we're getting the cans and bottles out of the dumpsters, but look at all the food that's coming right out of the kitchens and going to the dumpsters. So that actually became our second challenge, was how do we find a way to donate or find ways to divert food away from the waste stream. And then, as each couple of years went by, we'd look at another environmental impact of the events. And now we've expanded from Super Bowl into Pro Bowl and then eventually into the draft and the kickoff. And just, by keeping our eyes open and looking every year and seeing what should we be doing next once we get one thing under control.
Terribly impressive. I will talk more about it, but I was interested, and you clarified for this for me in our prep call a few weeks ago that what the NFL has control over, what you're responsible for, is not every game in the National Football League. You said, I think you said that each team has its own ownership, has its own management, fiercely independent. And then your role and the NFL's role is handling the Super Bowl, handling the Pro Bowl, and then, as you just said, handling the draft. Is that the way it works out?
Yeah, the league has control over special events. In terms of individual team operations, those are an individual team project. We don't have like control or authority over what the individual teams do, but we do have an informal consulting role with them. And we do chat with the operations managers from the different facilities. Sometimes we go to conferences and we meet up with them, and we'll all go out together. And, it's not just socializing. Everybody's swapping ideas and talking about what they're doing at their facility. So it's a good way to informally exchange information, in a really casual format, non-threatening, nobody's preaching at anyone. And it works out pretty well. So we get calls on a fairly regular basis where folks will have some type of environmental sustainability question, and they'll just say, what do you guys think about this? So it's an informal role, but it certainly has an impact, has an effect.
Well, it seems like a really valuable role, because if they are quite independent, it sounds like they're not meeting monthly and talking about all their initiatives, right? They're trying different things, and maybe you're the guy that gets all those, you're the reception point, you get all those ideas, and then you're able to bounce around and share and help replicate.
Well, we're actually in the beginnings, the beginning stages, about a year in, of having a more formal system where the teams, the team representatives can get together on a regular basis on a Zoom call. Yep. Sometimes have guest speakers, sometimes have a specific topic. It might be energy, it might be waste, and bring as many of the teams together as we can to sit in on those sessions and to, again, to share some information, ask a lot of questions, and just really to try and build that sense of community among folks who are actually working in their own communities.
And then would that be different from different kinds of sports teams? Or is there a uniqueness to the football versus basketball, hockey, baseball? It sounds like these are all just really big events, and you're managing really big events.
Well, I think that's true for all sports organizations. Right now we're looking at the NHL playoffs going on, big events in arenas all over North America. So I think every sports organization has, sort of those two separate areas. You've got the day-to-day operations of the facilities, but you also have the bigger events that bring all the resources together. And our mission with the NFL for all these 30 years has really been to focus on the special events. And again, it's for the very simple reason that the league itself has control and management control of those special events.
Yep. Let's back up just a little bit. How did you get into this? I was doing a little bit of poking around it. It looks like your sport, which you excelled at, was soccer. Is that correct?
Well, yeah. Well, I was a hockey player when I was a kid. But I spent decades coaching soccer and ultimately training other coaches, setting up coach training programs here in Rhode Island to train parents to become youth soccer coaches. So yeah, I've always had a real passion for both those sports. I was never a football player. So if you want to ask me any football questions, Ted, you'll have to submit them in writing, and I'll have to give them to somebody else, because I am not a football cognizant. The NFL has lots of football people. What they didn't have 30 years ago was an environmental guy.
Yeah, that's so funny. I was sure that you had played for some team, and that was your background. Well, then how did this come about? You were you were born and raised in Rhode Island. You went to community college in Rhode Island. You went to UMass Amherst, I guess, and you were also at Emerson College in journalism. Explain how you got to the NFL.
Well, my background is pretty varied. When I got out of college, I actually grew up in Massachusetts, I've continued to take classes since we moved to Rhode Island many years ago. But I graduated from college and I was a teacher, and I taught junior high level and taught at vocational schools. And then I got hit by the wave of layoffs and had to go back to school. There were no more teaching jobs available in Massachusetts, and I went back to school for journalism. became a television news reporter, became a radio reporter, a newspaper reporter, just sort of worked my way up through different media and worked in television for a while out in the West Coast, out in Washington State. And then I left that job to do some consulting work in communications. And it was funny because there was nobody doing communications work in environmental at the time. So my wife and I, we both sort of trained ourselves in environmental issues, and we started getting calls from folks who were, you know, who needed communications or PR help or something around environmental issues. And by working on these projects, we learned so much hands-on with all the hands-on experience. And we finally got to the point where we said, you know, we probably could manage some of these projects ourselves. We've been working side by side with folks for so long. So we started working on environmental projects. And then that was how the partnership with the NFL developed. Again, you know, just by simply going to the NFL and asking the question, what are you doing about environmental impact? But in terms of the community impact of sustainability, which is our main focus right now, is on what we can do around community legacy. That started in a very small way. We started doing community projects in our own neighborhood. We started going to the local school that our kids were going to and building community gardens and managing events there. So we do fundraising events for the school. So a lot of our event management experience, we learned just by doing little PTO projects and you know, started really small, trying to raise money in the neighborhood or build things to make our own neighborhood and our own community better. And more we developed those skills organically until eventually we said, boy, we could probably handle something like Super Bowl. And as it turns out, we could.
Well, when I think about what you're doing at these, you're planting trees, you're creating pollinator gardens, you're doing habitat restoration, You're creating sports equipment donation and recycling programs, school supply programs. You're recycling. You're composting. You're taking excess food off to drink to local food banks. You're using renewable energy and helping these organizations buy or helping get renewable energy credits so you can offset. That's a lot of stuff. Can you tell me, let's say you're working on next year's Super Bowl. When do you start to engage that community?
We typically start at least a year out, because we have to build a network. So for example, for things like material recovery, you know, if we're going to recover all the event materials, and you know, we're talking about lumber, we're talking about other building materials, we're talking about fabric, vinyl, decor, banners, signage material, turf, carpeting. There's a lot of stuff left over from these large events. Yeah. If we're going to our priority is to donate all that stuff within the host community for reuse. You know, while recycling is a good strategy or can be a good strategy, you know, we've got a hierarchy, you know, and at the top of that hierarchy is taking materials and reusing them, not tearing them down and trying to recycle them. So is there a way to reuse this stuff? Is there a way to repurpose or remanufacture it? And then down the road just a little bit is, well, we don't have those opportunities. Maybe we can recycle these materials. And then down the very bottom, we hit landfill. And that's what we're trying to avoid. We're trying to avoid hitting the bottom all the time. But in order to do that, we have to build a network with nonprofit organizations. And that's why it has to start about a year in advance. And when I say build a network, we'll reach out. I want to say in Las Vegas or in Kansas City is a good example. Kansas City was where the draft was last year, not this current one, but the one last year. We started out with a list of over 200 local nonprofit organizations that we reached out to and contacted. Of that, about 80 of them, you know, responded and said, yeah, we're interested in talking to you about getting donations of materials, repurposing them, reusing, finding things like that. And then we gradually began to hold meetings with them. We explained more about the types of materials, the types of uses, any restrictions that were on them. The only thing that's restricted is logo use has some guidelines and restrictions on it. Mm-hmm. We started working, and eventually it winnowed down to about 25 active organizations out of the original 200 that had the desire, the imagination, and the resources to reuse material, to build new structures, to use lumber, to use some of the fencing material that we use for their own events. And of those, you know, some of them, the names you would certainly recognize, folks like Habitat, folks like Salvation Army. And we hit these people up in every single community we go to. But at that point, we have to do the training sessions. So we'll hold a meeting, sometimes a monthly meeting, where we'll come into the market, we'll bring people together, and we'll talk over the logistics of how you recover all these, you know, hundreds of tons of materials in about 2 or 3 days. So we may do another session where we talk about all the uses that other cities have made of these materials. You know, in New Orleans, there was an organization that took our fence material and turned it into ball gowns. There was an organization in Minneapolis that took all of our fabric, and it was called Bundles of Love. They took the fabric and they got hundreds of volunteers from the local community to cut out patterns. They sewed it into little baby clothes outfits, bundled them together, and donated them to family shelters around the Twin Cities area. So we demonstrate all these different uses to organizations, and you can see the lights go on. You know, when they look, they say, oh, we could do that. We could try this. Because originally people will look at it and say, gosh, what are we going to do with all this material? We have a lot of this thin turf plasticky kind of carpet that we use as temporary flooring. We had decades where we threw that stuff in landfills. We just couldn't find, we couldn't conceive of a use for this stuff. And then when we were in Houston several years ago, somebody said, boy, that stuff would probably work pretty good for animal shelters. You know that? And ever since then, we've contacted animal shelters and zoos and other organizations and said, hey, we've got, you know, we've got 200,000 square feet of this stuff. And they say, hey, we'll take it all. We can use every scrap of it. So that's why we have to start so early, because it's not just a matter of going in and saying, hey, who wants this stuff? It's a matter of going in and building that network. And here's the legacy piece of it, Ted. And one thing I'd love to chat with you about is the whole concept of legacy, because so much of what we do is here today and gone tomorrow. But I mean, in sports organizations. But what our mission is to create legacy. So one of the legacies we create is once that network is built, you now have dozens of local organizations that have worked together. They understand the logistics of material recovery. They understand the reuse of material. We don't want that to go to waste. So what I will do is take that entire database, and let's say that the NBA All-Star Game is coming to that city next. We'll hand that off to them, and we'll say, look, the network's all built. It's the heavy lift is done. All you guys have to do is drop a dime on these folks. They know how to recover material. They know how to do this stuff. We'll also leave it with the city. We'll leave it with the local NFL team so that they can share it with anyone that comes into town. It doesn't matter to us whether it's NBA, NHL, X Games, Major League Baseball. Whoever's coming into town with events will have access to that database. So that becomes just one piece of legacy, something permanent that we can leave in a community after the last whistle has blown and the last fan, the last hot dog has been eaten and the last fan heads home with souvenirs.
That's fantastic. You're leveraging tremendous job. I mean, there you come in, you do one event, like one Super Bowl or one Pro Bowl, you establish this network, like you said, you're handing it off. You know, that stadium is being used many, many times during the year. I wanted to ask you about so congrats, by the way, that's very, very impressive. And exciting. Well, thank you, Jay. I wanted to ask you about the working with the food banks, because that really intrigued me that, you know, you're using, and I've looked at this in other cities, and it's always complicated dealing with the regulations around food and everything. But I was curious about how do you, like in Las Vegas, when you had this huge pulse of food and excess beverages, how do they absorb that? How are they ready for that?
Well, most of the food banks in a major city, most food banks are set up and have the flexibility to deal with a great big influx of food. They've all got freezers. They've all got cold storage. And as long as they know in advance, you know, and again, this is another thing that has to be prepped in advance. We can't just call up the night after Super Bowl and say, hey, we have 40,000 pounds of food. We have to work that out so that they can develop the resources necessary, make sure they've got the freezer space, also coordinate between, let's say, the stadium or the convention center and the food bank so that the food is handled according to those regulations you mentioned. You know, years ago, regulations were tough years ago. They're not as much now. I can remember many years ago, you know, 20 years ago, sometimes we'd go into a city And maybe one of our facilities that we're using for a big VIP event for several thousand people would say, well, no, we don't want to donate the food because we're concerned about liability. So there already was a Good Samaritan law on the federal level, but most states have their own state Good Samaritan law too. And what a Good Samaritan law does is it protects a donor from liability as long as they make a sincere effort to make sure that what they're donating is maintained and taken care of and done according to regulation. They don't have liability beyond that once it leaves their hands. Well, some organizations aren't even aware of it. One of the large catering organizations, one of the large national catering organizations that we dealt with at Super Bowl about 20 years ago said, no, our corporate policy is we don't donate any of the food. So we weren't trying to be heavy-handed, but we said, well, our corporate policy is that you do donate the food. We paid for it, and it's our food, and we want to donate it. I said, so how do we get from where you are to where we want to be? And so the local food bank brought in their legal representative. We had copies of the Good Samaritan law. We all sat down at the table, and we read through the law, and that service corporation decided to waive their regulations just for that one event. But within 2 years, they had waived it across their entire corporate structure, and now we're donating food from facilities. And they controlled food service at dozens of facilities all over the country. So it just was a matter of sort of cracking that first egg to realize that their business wasn't going to fall apart because they donated food. Not all food is appropriate for donation, though, too. We do look at some opportunities to do things like livestock feed. Some food that comes straight out of the kitchens, it's never served, and it never is out in a once it's out in a public area, even if it hasn't been touched, we consider it contaminated. So it has to be right from the kitchen for donation to a food bank or to a prepared food program. If it's been out in public, though, it can still be donated, but not as people food. It can be donated as animal food. And so sometimes we've been very fortunate to work out partnerships with local livestock farms, and they're more than happy to come and pick up that food. It's just a matter of making sure that stuff is separated both from the prepared food, and it has to be separated from trash too. It has to be relatively clean if it's going to go as animal feed.
And I would think it would give that food service company great PR, right? That they're providing, they're supporting that initiative.
Absolutely. Yeah, because food waste, as you and I both know, food waste is just an enormous problem in this country. You see figures all over the place, and I could even make up better figures if you give me a couple of minutes. But you see different figures all over the time. But one of the figures I saw recently was that one third of all the food that we buy ends up waste. It ends up being thrown away. I don't know how accurate that figure is, but it rings true with me.
It's a it's a big number, and it's a big shame. You mentioned figures. I mean, throw around some figures like a Super Bowl. I mean, in Las Vegas, you threw around 40,000 pounds. Is that about the amount of excess food there might be coming out of a single event?
Well, we don't separate the food and beverage, usually. And we have a lot more beverages to donate than food afterwards. So, for example, our major beverage sponsor is Pepsi. Pepsi will bring in, maybe hundreds of pallets of beverages that are served at some of our events. Well, there's always beverages left over. Just like if you have folks over for dinner, you don't want to run out. So you always have extra. So there's always extra. And it could be 20, 30 pallets of Gatorade, bottled water, soft drinks, plus packaged snacks and things like that. So we set up programs to donate all that, and we count that in as food and beverage. So we've had... I don't know if there's really an average figure, because it bounces anywhere from 20,000 up to about 150,000 when you add in the food and the beverages that get donated. So
that's pounds of food and drink, or pounds of beverages.
Anywhere from number. I think the lowest number we've ever documented was about 25,000. The highest was closer to 150,000. So it's a lot, and it would have been a lot of waste. And of course we always set aside, we got a big crew that handles the breakdown after an event like Super Bowl or the draft. So we make sure that we always set aside pallets of water and stuff like that for them as well, too. So none of it goes to waste. Most of it gets donated, but we want to make sure that the folks that are out there working, especially if they're working in Las Vegas or Phoenix or someplace like that, we got to keep them well hydrated as well, too.
Let's shift. This is fantastic. I want to shift to the planting of trees. It looked like in Las Vegas, or actually in Henderson, Nevada, that you planted a whole bunch of trees. Can you kind of describe how that came about? I mean, this is all part of that networking that you're talking about, but I was curious about how that came about, and also then how are those trees going to be maintained, or who's going to look after them, make sure that they live?
Oh, Ted, you're hitting the sweet spot right now. You know, I mean, the community greening, when we talk about legacy, you know, trying to create some permanent benefit in these host communities, the greening program, that as well as the Super Kids program, which we can talk about, but the greening program is really par excellence when it comes to creating a permanent legacy, and it really inspires the folks in the different communities. What we do is this, it's pretty simple. We create a fund each year. Part of that fund comes from the local host committee, the local Super Bowl host committee. They have a lot of different responsibilities around media and around all kinds of stuff around the events. But part of their responsibility is to match our donation. So we now have gotten to the point where we start off with a grant fund of $100,000 or more. Some of that is NFL money. Some of that comes in from Verizon. Verizon's our main greening sponsor. Some comes in from the local host committee, and some comes in from sponsors of the local host committee. But anyway, we usually end up now with about $100,000 to start with, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it's, well, maybe it sounds like a lot. I don't know. But what we do is we put together a program of matching grants. So again, when we talk about going into the community early and often, we have to get the lay of the land. We have to find out two things. Who are the nonprofit agencies that are working on greening their own community? And what are the issues that that community is facing where we can have an impact? What are the folks in Las Vegas care about? What are the folks in Kansas City care about? It's not always the same sustainability issues in every city. So we have to educate ourselves on what they really care about. So we'll go into that community. We don't do a shotgun approach on grant money. What we do is we find out who's actually working in those spaces, and then we target them to send them an RFP for a grant. We meet with them informally and talk through it and give them an idea of what we'd like to do. And the grants can range anywhere from, you know, depending on whether we give out 10 grants or whether we give out 15 grants, which I think in Las Vegas, we gave out 15 different grants for 15 different projects in the city. So the grant recipient has to match that. It doesn't always have to be a cash match, though. It could be resources, plant material, site prep. There's a lot of ways to match that money. But built right into each grant is a provision that says that the grant recipient has to guarantee a minimum of 2 years of care and maintenance. Because for most greening projects in a community, if you take really good care of them for 2 years, then they're well established, and we know that they're gonna survive. But we also want people to have skin in the game. So that's why it's a matching grant program. I know a lot of folks, you know, a lot of agencies that give grants will say, here's some money, you know, to do stuff with. But we don't want to do it. We want to say, tell us a project that you care enough about that you want to invest in it, and we'll invest in it too. Because now we know that it's something that's going to last and that's going to work out. The projects are all over the place. I'll tell you about one of the stunning ones. In Miami, the head of the host committee came to us and said, hey, what about doing something underwater? And we said, well, we usually don't plant trees underwater. What are you thinking of? And he said, the biggest problem we have right now in Miami is the destruction of the coral reefs. And so we did what we do best, which is we build coalitions and partnerships. So we got matched up with an organization called Force Blue. These folks are all retired combat divers, you know, special operations, Marines, Air Force, Army. These are special ops combat divers, and they work on marine conservation projects. Then we got together with marine scientists from University of Miami and from other organizations in Miami, and we built a coalition, a really good-sized coalition. We even got some state and some federal money as well, too. And we organized a project called 100 Yards of Hope, and we were able to go out, harvest coral, and rebuild a section of coral reef using new genotypes of coral that are climate resistant and disease resistant, because that's what's killing off the coral reefs around Florida. And the impact of that is enormous, because the coral reefs help blunt storm surges. The coral reefs also are a huge sink for carbon in the ocean. The coral reefs also are sort of the nursery of the oceans. Like, most of the food chain starts with coral and works its way up. So if the coral collapses, If the coral reefs collapse, most of the food chain in the ocean is likely to collapse, you know, within a certain number of years as well, too. So that's just an example of how what we've learned over the last 30 years is that we can accomplish almost anything, but we can't do it by ourselves. We've got to find like-minded people. We've got to find the resources. And resources are not just money. I mean, the skills that these combat divers had, money cannot buy those skills. I mean, these guys and gals are just incredible. In fact, my wife Susan and I went with them on their first dive to harvest coral. And I will never make that mistake again, because going out and swimming with Navy SEALs is kind of like going out jogging with Usain Bolt. I mean, it's just, I was a wreck. Susan says she'd do it any day of the week. She had a great time. God. Me,
I can see why you've won this environmental leadership award from the Green Sports Alliance, Jack. Just fantastic. You and Susan have done just fantastic work. We're out of time, but I do want to extend our time slightly, because I want to hear about that Super Kids program. And is that the sports equipment program or the recycling program?
Yeah, we just celebrated the 25th anniversary of that program this past year in Las Vegas. It's a really heartwarming program, and Susan absolutely takes the lead on that program. I think she lives each year for that event. What we do is we recruit schools in the market. We'll recruit up to 100 schools as donor organizations. And sometimes we'll recruit. I think in Las Vegas, we also worked with YMCAs and county parks and rec departments as well, too. It's a really broad program. And then we find recipients. And we had, you know, again, we have close to 100 recipients. And those can be low-income schools. They can be recreation programs, youth organizations. But what it is during the month of January, schools will collect, the donating schools will collect books, sports equipment, games, school supplies, things that are desperately needed in low-income areas in that community. And they'll collect those at their own schools. And then we hold one great big event a couple of weeks before Super Bowl, and it's the Super Kids Super Sharing event. Mm-hmm. And all those schools will send a couple of kids, a couple of adults, and we'll collect all that stuff in one huge gymnasium where it all gets sorted into bins and labeled and all that kind of stuff. And typically the local team, you know, in this case, the Raiders came and they brought players and they brought, you know, staff from the Las Vegas Raiders. They also brought all their play equipment, which they set up in a field next door. So the kids all come in the morning, they sort out through all this stuff, and then they get to go out and play for an hour or two with the Las Vegas Raiders as kind of a reward. We also will get a local musical group, usually a student musical group, and we'll highlight them and have them perform at the event too. And you can imagine what a thrill it is for kids to be able to go back home and say, yeah, I sang at a Super Bowl event last week. So the net impact of this is this. I think the lowest amount we've ever collected in a community, at least since the program expanded, is in the 20,000s, you know, maybe 28,000 items in 1 hour, in one morning. But we've collected up to, hey, Susan, what's the biggest number we ever collected? 50,000. Okay. I'm just called friend to get an answer.
That's great. That is great.
Up to 50,000 items collected in 1 hour. And before the day is out, before the sun sets, all of that stuff is, you know, we have to, again, we set up a logistics chain that's really powerful. All that stuff is actually in the hands of the schools and youth programs and everywhere. By the end of the day, we're cleaned out. Everything is gone. And it's been donated. And in some communities, they've liked the concept so much, they've started their own programs, annual programs to do this. But I have to tell you about the personal impact on this. As you know, and I know, and everybody who listens to this knows, teachers are not incredibly well-funded in this country. I have never met a teacher, and I was a teacher myself for a couple of years out of college, and my son-in-law is a teacher. I've never met a teacher who didn't have to dip into their own pocket from time to time just to get the supplies and resources they need to take care of the kids who they're responsible for. So when we were in Minneapolis, for example, and I think in Minneapolis, I think we hit 50,000 items in 1 hour in Minneapolis. We had a local company EMC, I think was the name of the company. They were replacing all of their practically brand new iPads with the next generation of iPad, you know, going from an iPad 5.2 to 5.3, you know, whatever. Everybody has to replace everything. And they had 2,500 iPads in their headquarters, plus chargers and wire cables and all this kind of stuff. So they called and they said, do you think that the schools could use a couple of thousand iPads? Well, we ended up being able to give each of the participating schools a couple of dozen virtually brand new iPads along with chargers. And there were teachers in that event who came up in tears to Susan. I mean, literally came up and hugged her with tears in their eyes and saying, you know, these are the kind of things that I could never dream of affording for my kids. We just don't have a budget for this. And she said, what a difference this makes to have some technology in our classrooms. So when you look at the individual impact that it has, not just on teachers, but on the kids that those teachers serve, that's why I say it's a really heartwarming event to have, too. And I do want to mention, too, Ted, that in the community legacy piece of it, too, we also we don't do this at every event, but at selected events, we do something we call Salute to Service, where we bring in military and retired military and former military folks. And we have a screening of there was a wonderful documentary film made about that coral reef project. It's a terrific film. I wish it was available on Netflix or someplace, but someday it might be. But a movie was made of that. And we bring in the military audience because it's a great piece that shows not only the rehabilitation of a coral reef, but it shows how these military folks rehabilitate themselves by finding a new mission and a new purpose in their lives. So that's another event that we occasionally run. And another thing that we do is, again, not every year, but we look at the opportunity to do a career seminar with local students who are interested in sports and sustainability. And we'll bring in a couple of selected speakers to talk to them, but not to talk to them about sport and sustainability per se. We bring a couple of speakers who are at the top of their game and we say, tell us how you got from being a college student to where you are now. Tell us about the steps, the missteps, the failures, the successes, and how you got there. Because we want to inspire these kids to realize that a career, whether it's sports or sustainability or business or medicine, it doesn't matter. But a career is not this smooth path that just goes up the hill. That for most of us, our career, and like you, for you too, Ted, you didn't start off as a podcaster. You know, I'm sure if you look back a certain number of years, you'd say, yeah, I never thought I'd be doing this. You know, and it's absolutely the same thing with me, you know, and our careers are never this one smooth, unbroken line. It's always a bunch of fits and starts where we're moving in different direction and trying different things until we hit that niche, that sweet spot where we say, this is where I think I really belong. So that's what we try and do with those,
students. Yeah. Awesome. Well, listen, Jack, and congratulations to your wife, Susan, as well, who is there. You guys are just making an extraordinary impact. I would never have dreamt that the NFL would have this sort of reach in the communities that it plays in. But thanks so much for being on the podcast. We'll have to do another episode because you got so many great stories, and this is a continuing chapter in your life. So thanks again, Jack.
All right, thank you, Ted. My pleasure.
That's it. Thanks for listening to Flanagan's Ecologic. We'll see you next time.